National Public Radio. And, you know, every so often there's essays by different guests and whatnot. Baxter Black, the cowboy poet, the sports curmudgeon, is on every Wednesday, and Daniel Shore, who's on in the evenings. And whereas you're going to find that these guys are really well-read, and they kind of, that's where they drew their inspiration, mine actually came from listening to essays being read aloud. And when after listening to these things for a while, I started to realize that it sounded really cool. And I wanted to sound really cool, too. Maybe not on the radio. I don't think that radio is a forte of mine. I don't have a radio voice. But I knew that it was something that just sparked from within me, and I knew that that's what I wanted to learn how to do better. And I also knew that, there, like design, it's not likely that you can just go buy a book and read a book, and there you are. I'm a writer. I can write now because I've read a book. It doesn't work that way. And so I knew that I had to get started. I knew that the only way for me to get to where the Baxter Blacks and the Daniel Shores are, the guys who've been writing for a long time, is I had to get my time in. I had to pay my dues, and hopefully in 20 years, I can sound as good as they do. And you know, my wife will be the one that reads it and tells me that I sound as good as they do. So, you know, I got up this gumption to write, and then the internet started getting a little bit more interesting with the tools that made it possible to write on a regular basis and not have to worry about how am I going to manage this site on, you know, every day and make all these manual updates. I can just go to a site, put some content in, put a title in, one word or more, and hit publish, and it's out there, and I've written something. But it took me about a year to get to that point. And it took me a year because it's very scary to put words out there. And online, in print, whatever, they feel like those are things you can't take away. And so you've got to get it right the first time. Or you make small edits and then you catch hell for that later. But you put that out there and you leave it alone and you let it live, and then, oh my God, your thoughts, your combined experiences, your education, all these things are out there in your writing and in your style. And I remember publishing my first post to Airbag, and here it is. And this is nothing. I mean, this is me using three sentences or so to quickly convey an event that happened at work. It was no biggie. But pushing that out there, you know, clicking a submit or a publish button, and then waiting and thinking, you know, has anybody seen this yet? And what do they think? And inside me was that fear that one person would see this and then promptly email 5,000 people to tell them how stupid I am and how I cannot write to save my life, that English must be a second or third language to me. And, you know, it was scary. Even though I knew that it was just my wife, probably some family, and whatever coworker I could pull into the office and say, oh, look, I wrote something, please look at this. That was it. That was all that was reading this, but it was still, to me, very scary. And I bring this up, and I'm talking about this today. This is my portion. Because I run across people like this all the time, whether they are people who are amateurs like myself who just want to write for the sake of writing because it's a great creative outlet, or the business owner who is struggling to come up with the words and the prose to talk about his products or his services. All of these different types of people and these different types of scenarios, they all suffer from the same thing, and that is getting rid of that nervousness, that feeling in your gut that if I put this out here, I'm going to be judged and later on maybe crucified. And that's just not the case, but it takes getting started and getting out there, and after a while you you develop a thick skin, hopefully, and you just move on. I have to scroll down. So what I tell people in getting started and to try to get relaxed is that they need to write a kitchen table conversation, meaning that, and this is my experience, and so far it's worked for me, that is why I'm here, and instead of worrying about the proper structure, instead of worrying about the proper use of English, the thing to focus on is to tell a really good story. And not all stories are going to be funny, ha-ha. This can be a story about, again, your product or service, the sandwich you had at lunch, whatever it is. But in order for content or for writing to be good, I think every writer just wants to tell a good story. And the way to do that is to think about it as I am talking to someone across the kitchen table. I'm having an informal discussion. If you're giving a presentation and you're up on the stage by yourself, you're speaking in a different way than if you were at a coffee shop or a bar or a restaurant with your friends. It's a different environment, and it's a more casual environment. But that's what the internet is. There are times when more professional writing and more professional styles are necessary. But for the most part, especially getting started, getting over those hurdles, just talk to your dog. Talk to whomever that you feel the most comfortable for. Write for that person. And it could be yourself. There's a lot of times when I'm writing on airbag, and I'm writing for myself. I'm telling myself the story. That's how I get the words out. Those may be edited later, but that's the only way that I can get it done is I'm retelling the tale to myself. Or I may try a different style, and I'll get to that in a second, but that's originally how I got started. I had to kind of visualize things and then reread it and make sure that made sense. And the same thing is when you're telling someone a story, you can also, it's okay to screw up. You can get out there and you could say, hey, we went down to this and we talked to this guy and then this guy pulled a gun and then we fled. Oh, but wait a second, I gave him my money first. You know, and it's that kind of just relaxed or chillax feeling that everybody just needs to kind of have. And I think that's just the best way. And you're going to find, too, that's if you learn to relax and you bring that into your everyday writing mind, you're going to get a lot better product when you're done. And check which slide we're on. So, again, I think that good writing is story structure. It's not about which semicolons, which commas, which em dashes. Are you using a footnote? What is this stuff? And to me, this is alien language. These are symbols that were somehow communicated to Ben Franklin or somebody. And then he said, that's brilliant. We got to work that into the English language.
Yeah, that or they're just really jacked up emote icons.
Like, yeah, exactly.
I have no idea what that means.
Sort of a Siamese twin type of thing.
Yeah,
right there.
With a really tall conjoined hat.
One's winking. Hello, ladies. For me, this became a stumbling block because when I wanted to write, I'm listening to these guys and I'm thinking, my God, if I could just sound like that. Then it came to these things. And this is one part that prevented me from getting started. It was, what is that? And if I put one here, is one over here required? Where's the comma go? And a lot of this has to do, admittedly, with me not thinking about or really caring about the English language during high school. For me, algebra was right up there with English. So just as you don't use algebra to balance your checkbook, I didn't use English to, design or bag groceries back when I was younger. So when it came to this, it became a stumbling block, and then I just thought, I can't care. and people are going to call me out on it, and I can go back and I can edit that, I guess, or I can just learn, and hopefully along the way, I will know the difference between a semicolon and a colon and a comma. And I want to tell you that after 5 years, I still don't know what those things mean. And I still get hate mail from time to time from the English police, and that's okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's
thanks,
me.
Thanks, Ethan. So don't get caught up on this. Tell your story. There's books that will show you with diagrams how to use these things if they're important. But really what is important is that you can write a story and someone across the world can read it, and they know what you're trying to say, that they get the story. And then hopefully as you go along, as you progress, you can tell a joke and it can make perfect sense to you, and you're laughing at yourself hysterically, and your wife and your cats are looking at you like you're a tard. But to you, this is the funniest thing you've written in a really long time, and you put it on the internet and hope to God that someone in Australia has the same sense of humor as you and gets it. And it's a big dice roll. But that's, that's the whole point. So to continue this, getting started and kind of honing is to find your voice. And again, this is practice. After a while, you'll find that you're going to start writing in a particular style. I try different things to try not to sound the same all the time. And my panel informed me this morning that I have failed utterly. So apparently that's not working out for me too well. But what I mean by this is I think that you find a voice and you find a particular way of telling stories and communicating via writing is that you try to tell different stories. You get yourself out of a comfort zone. You tell it in different ways and different perspectives. A couple weeks ago, maybe it was a month ago even, I wrote about how someone had really screwed up my Wall Street Journal. And I was pissed because I went out, I opened the garage, got the Wall Street Journal, picked it up, it felt about a pound lighter, and I went to go hold it, and my right arm fell off because someone had shortened it, and obviously somebody had screwed up. And I was really, really angry. So I went upstairs and I wrote about it, because that's going to show them. And so what I did is I thought, well, I'm going to be clever, instead of just saying I am mad because my Wall Street Journal has been changed. I was trying to come off as someone who was really angry, and they were talking about why they're angry and talking about failure and when teams fail, when a failure like this has happened, that someone should get shot, or this is the extent of my anger through words communicated on the internet. And then I ended by saying that someone had spilled McClatchy on my Wall Street Journal. And I just thought, oh, brilliant. This is clever. And someone's going to have to Google this to know just how clever I am. And that didn't work either, because nobody bothered to really Google McClatchy, and I guess this didn't connect. And to me, I was patting myself on the back. You know, I go to Starbucks. I just wrote something clever. You should check it out. It's on Airbag. Ever heard of it? And no, she hadn't. I got my latte, and I took off. But getting back to my point on sleep, the point of that is that you're trying to get yourself into a situation where you're not telling the same story over and over again. The kitchen table conversation is great, but you don't want to keep coming to the table with the same story, telling it the same way. And so another way to do this is to talk or write about topics that you're not passionate about, which to me is exactly opposite of what a lot of the conventional wisdom is with writing online. Find a topic that you're passionate about and write about it. I love puppy dogs. But instead go write about something that you have absolutely no idea what this is or why other people are so passionate about it. And the reason for that is it's a great brain exercise, is because then you're having to do the research. You're having to look into why people care about this thing. And then if you can retell the tale or retell the story or communicate to that group in the same way that a person is passionate about, I mean, that's an achievement. You can go to Starbucks that morning and you can say, I just wrote something to a group I have no idea who they are and what they're passionate about, and I just post it, and I'm brilliant. But it is a big pat on the back. If you look at David Foster Wallace, who I've only read about 6 pages of his stuff, but there's an article about something to do with the lobster festival in Maine. Names escape me. And instead of just going up there and writing about this lobster festival in Maine, we went to Maine. We had lobster. People had fun. He took and just went way into it. And he talked about the history of the town. He talked about how lobsters are born and how they grow up to be big lobsters, and then how evil men's pull them out of the water and turn them into food products. And then he goes on to talk about the girl who was crowned Miss Crab Festival, Maine, 2000 whatever. And he just goes on and on and on. And it's not exhaustive as much as it is you can see that he got involved. And for him to put himself into that environment, which I don't think David Foster Wallace is an expert of, maybe now, but he wasn't before, and to just bring back all that detail and to be able to retell it in a way that was interesting. I mean, that's a home run. And that, to me, is what I hope to get to. That's what the guys that, like Baxter Black and Daniel Shore, that's what they do on a daily basis. So my last point, and I got to be fast here because I'm taking more time, is the internet is not a truck, it's a mosh pit. And what I mean by that is that when you write content out there, you're pushing it out. It is scary as hell because, sure enough, especially today with more people on the internets, you're going to put something out there, and 2 minutes later, someone's going to email you, "You're an absolute moron. You need to turn the internet off and go dig ditches." And that's going to come. And you need to get that email and reply and say, "Thank you. I hate you, but thank you." And you need to move on. Do not let people deter you from writing. And do not let people deter you from writing the way that you want to write. I mean, take what they say. And if you're getting 100 emails and people are saying, "Really, I don't get this. If you could just move your semicolon over here, it would make much more sense." Then maybe take that and start instead of change your style, carve your style, whittle it down, keep refining until you found your groove. I am not anything like what I want to be when it comes to writing. In other words, I'm not the Daniel Shore, the Baxter Black, and I don't care that I am right now. I don't care that people don't like some of the things that I have to write. That's going to happen, and you can't make everybody happy. Even the people you make happy on a daily basis, there's going to be that one time that you write something that's going to completely piss them off, and they'll write you hate mail, and maybe they'll come back a couple months later and continue reading what you've written. Don't let that get you down. So, I am the constant amateur, and like I said, I do this because it's fun, and some way, somehow, I've managed to get my writing to the point that people can follow along the stories that I'm trying to say. But I wanted some other more expert opinions, some help up here to give you other perspectives. And so with us, and in honor of our early morning... got raindrops on the stage. Raindrops on the stage. So, in honor of our early morning little soiree here, we have the Breakfast Club. I'm Greg Story, the amateur. This is Ethan Marcotte, the reader. Bronwyn Jones, the professional. Sorry, Ethan. And Aaron Kassane, the editor. Watch out for the rain.
Actually, I think we're good. I don't think I can top that, Greg. We can probably close up now, but... So hi, my name is Ethan Marcotte. I was telling these guys earlier that I actually feel like a fraud sort of twice over. A few years ago, I graduated from a college in Vermont with a literature degree, English literature, where I read a lot of really boring plays and poems that I don't actually refer to anymore because now I run a web design shop in Cambridge. So the past couple years I've been talking about web design and training people about web design, and now I have to actually pretend like I know something about the thing that I was actually trained in, rather than pretending to be a web designer for all these past couple years. But so whereas back in the day, a blank Word doc or a blank piece of paper would terrify the crap out of me like it used to Greg, this is what scares me now. You know, for those of you podcasting at home, this is a blank Photoshop document. And back in the day when I started on like a pirated copy of Photoshop 3 with no design training whatsoever. This was more terrifying to me than it was now. I mean, it still keeps me up at night. But to sort of get over that hurdle of, what the hell am I doing here? I don't, you know, stranger in a strange land sort of thing. I mean, I sort of turned into this, like, design minor bird. You know, I got started on, like, sites like DeviantArt or go down to the used, like, CD store or something like that, looking at packaging and really just trying to get past, like, an aesthetic reaction of, like, oh, that's really pretty, and trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, what is it about this that, you know, I think is good? You know, just the mechanics behind, like, really good design and trying to figure out what is it about these styles that's, you know, appealing to me and really resonating with me, and trying to bring that into my own work and not only, you know, not... you know, plagiarizing it or anything like that, but just trying to have a conversation with it, trying to take somebody else's style and, you know, modify it and learn from it. And that, you know, really is, you know, in thinking about this panel, this is something that I've come back to, because this is really a lot of what I studied in school, you know, looking at the ways that different authors sort of talk to each other. You know, they might be separated by decades or centuries, but there are conventions that everyone uses that, whether they're conscious of it or not, people have been using before them. And it's those, like, sources of inspiration that I think, at least for me, when I'm starting with a writing assignment, I find kind of comforting. This is a Walt Whitman poem. This is actually one of my favorite poems, called "To a Locomotive in Winter." And the poem's about just that. It's about this this locomotive that's, like, mired under with snow and ice, and it's rusted, and it's you know, it's this huge, immovable, immobile beast. And he's using consonants here, not like, you know, everything but A, E, I, O, U, but, you know, consonants, like using very hard word sounds to sort of, like, you know, butt up against each other. Thee for my recitative, thee in the driving storm even as now, the snow, the winter day declining, thee in thy panoply, thy measured duel throbbing in thy beat convulsive. I know it's really early for stupid, boring poems, but... I mean, it's almost hard to read out loud, and what he's doing is he's, like, painting an audio, like an audible picture of just how, like grand but frozen this thing is, because you can barely get through the sentences, just like this thing can, you know, it's framed in ice, and I think that's really beautiful, and you know, it's that kind of consonance that I think, you know, other writers can be kind of inspired by. Whenever I have, like, a blank page in front of me, I'll put on Soul Coughing's Ruby Vroom, which is kind of like my white album. I think Mike Doty, you know, like, just on a lyric sheet, is, like, one of my favorite writers ever. And he's basically doing the same thing that Whitman is. The song Screenwriter's Blues starts off, exits to freeways twisted like knots on the fingers, jewels cleaving skin between breasts. And the song is, like, spoken word. I mean, he's not singing a lick of it, really. And his voice almost trips up on the words that he wrote, you know, the sense of being lost and completely, like, alone. But then he moves into this beautiful passage about your Cadillac breathes 400 horses over blue lines. You were going to Reseda to make love to a model from Ohio whose real name you don't know. And the consonants is gone. He's got direction. You know, it's just these smooth sounds. It's a straight line. And I think it's just really beautiful how he's taken this, like, this acknowledged device, you know, this consonants, and moved a dissonance, rather, and moved into, you know, this just, you know, this consonants, this beautiful smooth sounds. This doesn't just happen in literature. I mean, this happens in every medium. I was almost an accidental music major in college. I had like a jazz theory and performance thing, which was almost as useful as my English lit degree was. Somebody handed me a Thelonious Monk CD in my second year of college, and I was just, like, blown away by it. I hadn't heard anything like it before. I just started, like, this really obsessive, compulsive, like, buying binge, where I started, you know, not only following, you know, Thelonious Monk, but the people that had played with him on that first album that I've been giving, and then, you know, the people that had played with them, and, you know, just following this, like, weird family tree of folks that had, like, either played together or whatever. And not only did I end up with, like, this freakishly large CD collection and, you know, getting deeper and deeper in debt, but... after a while, you start, like, seeing these, like, these phrases that pop up, like, on different albums. Like, somebody else had written this this lick, and somebody else would adopt it, and then they just mess with it. Like, you know, it's not like like Sonny Rollins would just stop it, like something that he'd done with Max Roach. You know, he'd, you know, put it in a different tempo or put it in a different tinge or something like that, where he'd made it his own. He's got this phrase as a launching point, and then he just moves on to something completely new and exciting. And so it's stuff like that that really got me excited back in school. And
hello, ladies.
Yeah. 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 I was going to wear a doublet today just to try to alienate you guys a little bit more. But yeah, just to continue on with the why I have so much success with the ladies. This was my senior thesis, which I won't talk about too long. But if anybody's... So Paradise Lost was this poem written by this guy, John Milton, and it doesn't end like most poems should. After 12 or so lines, it talks about puppies and sunflowers, and then you're done. This thing goes on for years. It's thousands and thousands of lines, and he's basically talking about Genesis, the book in the Bible, not the Phil Collins band. And it's about as exciting for most people as it seems. But the thing that really got me excited about this is like the biggest like literary mixtape ever. This guy just like adopts so many different styles in his book and just puts them in this completely new context. It's really just like having somebody hand you a CD and be like, hey, I thought this was really cool. You should check this out. And, you know, it's a launching point for discovering new styles and finding out about new authors that you haven't hit before. But, yeah, I'm going to try to breeze through this because even when I'm reading this now, it starts making my eyelids droop. But so if you haven't read the poem, it starts off in hell. Satan is the hero. He's basically like cast in like these like huge like Greco-Roman terms. He's handsome, he's beautiful, he's glowing, and but you know he's Satan. He's in hell. What does the reader think? But there's this passage about his shield. Like you know he's a epic warrior. He's got this you know beautiful shield on his back. But the thing that Milton is doing, he's actually almost like riffing on a passage that this guy Virgil did before him in this other epic poem called the Aeneid. Now, for Milton, there's sort of like two big epic poets before him, Virgil and Homer. And they're kind of like the Jeffrey Zellman and the Doug Bowman of epic poetry. So basically, what Milton's doing is, I mean, he's acknowledging the fact that this thing has come before him, and he's sort of putting it in his own framework, but he's putting his own twist in it. You know, so both of these shields, you know, they're crafted in the heavens, la di da. But whereas Virgil's poem. Whereas Virgil's shield is, you know, this beautifully wrought golden shield that has all these figures of Roman wars and, you know, just like detailing the hero's like amazing history. Satan's shield is, you know, it's this dull, silver, really battered thing. It's imperfect, and hey, it's Satan. But almost what Milton is doing is, I mean, it's like a little bid for authority. It's like a rap war between like a couple dead white guys. It's he's like, oh, your rhymes were great, old man, and they're okay for the introductory book to my poem, you know, when I'm in hell talking about Satan.
Wicked, wicked.
Yeah, exactly. And because what he's doing is he's taking all this like this classical tradition that he's mired in, that everyone is going to be coming to this book with all these expectations. So you have to live up to these guys. So he's like, okay, great. Here they are. They're in hell. You know, this is an imperfect, flawed thing. And then he moves to earth, and then he moves to heaven throughout the course of this huge poem, and he drops it all. He moves in this like beautifully lyric passages, you know, and he develops his own voice. But, you know, Homer and Virgil, you know, these guys were great, but, you know, we're just going to keep them in the, you know, in the prelude to the really important stuff, moving into heaven. So stuff like that is really cool. It doesn't have to be just really boring white guys. I mean, one of my other favorite pieces of writing ever is Alan Moore's Watchmen. And this is a perfect example of this. I mean, he's basically taken characters from the DC universe and made these like really flawed versions of them and just put them in his own like twisted little story and done something completely new with them. Each one of the characters, you know, Night Owl, Rorschach, I mean, they have like actual like counterparts, but you know, they're completely new and exciting. And it's stuff like this that when I am reading a book or when I'm listening to a CD that really inspires me, when I'm doing writing, I take a little comfort from this because somebody else that I consider great has probably done the same thing. They've needed a launching off point, and that they can, you know, read stuff like this and, you know, start from something new. I heard David Sedaris speak in Boston a couple years ago, and he actually had this passage about how he was just talking about some random author that nobody had ever heard of, but he was just raving about her. And he actually said that, you know, when he finds a passage that he loves, he'll type it out, like blank piece of paper, word processor, and just retype it, just to sort of get in the person's head and feel what greatness feels like. And I thought that was kind of cool. So I think it's really important to have like your own sort of like pantheon of rock stars, or you know, find the people that really inspire you and figure out why they inspire you, and just try to see what you can sort of learn from that. I mean, for my part, I've got a couple that I just wanted to share with you guys really quickly, but Sarah Vowell. I hadn't read On Radio before, and I picked it up before the plane ride to Boston, to Austin, and I've just been devouring it. I mean, I love her writing in general, but in this book, she's got this incredibly, like, terse, packed language. I mean, it's just so tight and, like, so, like, edited down. She comes from a journalism background, and but, you know, sort of underneath it is just, like, this incredible, like, feeling, and it's just that economy of language that I think, like, sometimes if I'm getting a little too flowery and, you know, my 50-word sentences could probably be trimmed down a little bit. I try to read something from her and, you know, just try to remember that, no, I don't need to spend 6 pages telling about what I had, you know, how great my oatmeal was this morning.
But that was a good story.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
Yeah.
And then another person sort of on the other side of things is Angela Carter, who, if you guys haven't read, she's just amazing. You know, but she's really like reading you know, she's the literary version of, like, eating chocolate cake. I mean, it's just, like, these really dense, beautifully lyric, you know, passages. And it's just, like, every paragraph is perfect. And then kind of on the other side of things, just from, a pacing standpoint, is if anyone's ever read P.G. Wodehouse, this guy is just crazy. And Douglas Adams, who I also admire as a writer, said this guy was the best comic writer in the English language. And he had this. Adams had this anecdote of Wodehouse. Every time he was writing a draft, he would write a manuscript, and then he'd take each page of the manuscript and basically like tack it along his study, like on the wall up against the floor. And then as he revised each page, he'd raise it a little higher and higher. And basically, he wouldn't consider the damn manuscript finished until he'd had you know, every paper you know touching the ceiling. Now it's probably bullshit, but I think it's a cool story. And you do get the sense that everything that he writes is just so perfectly paced that, you know, he must have spent, you know, months on even the shortest Jeeves and Wooster story. So anyway, I think people really should check this guy out if they haven't already. And that's pretty much it. So, yeah, I think really the main thing is, you know, just find your rock stars. Find the people who inspire you, whether it's other bloggers, whether it's books, whether it's films, and screenwriters, or you know what have you, and try to get past the aesthetic reaction. I love this. I think this is great. Try to figure out why. You know, if they're using literary devices, if they've just got like a narrative style that you really dig, just try to get under the skin a little bit, and then just riff on them. I mean, it's not a one-to-one thing. You're not trying to, you know, write like Greg Story, write like Bronwyn Jones,
Don't like Greg like Story.
Yeah, but you know, you're trying to have a conversation with their style and making your own. So, thank you.
Okay, I guess that's me. Greg has dubbed me the professional, which makes me sound like an assassin, which is kind of badass. But really, it's just because I'm a marketing copywriter and I work for Apple. I've been a marketing copywriter, an in-house marketing copywriter, for about 7 years. So technically, yes, I do get paid for what I do. That makes me a professional. Only reflects, you know, that aspect of professionalism, not at all my work ethic. So, moving on. I'm here to talk to you about style. Formally, style is what William Strunk and E.B. White describe as the principal requirements of plain English. That's from the introduction of Elements of Style, which is the sort of seminal writer's desk reference. Get one if you don't already have one. But I think it's safe to say that most of us think of writer's style as being their voice on the page. Ernest Hemingway's style is different than Edith Wharton's. David Foster Wallace's style is different than David Sedaris's, even though their names are both David. How weird. We hear these writers' voices from the page, and that's voice. That's style and voice sort of conflated. But for today's purposes, I would like to think of voice as being writer-specific and style as being medium-specific. So as long as we're talking about medium, why don't we talk about our favorite medium, the web? At least I hope it's our favorite medium. Otherwise, I'm really off base.
That's wonderfully topical.
So, yeah. Nice segue, huh? I want to talk about web style, or maybe it's the web, capital W, at least according to the Associated Press Style Guide, it's capital W, because it's short for World Wide Web. Therefore, it should be capitalized, which means a website is not a website at all. It's actually a website. But that looks kind of weird, I think. Not as weird as that. That's just kind of intimidating and scary. High drama. High drama at the writing panel. Anyway, I think we need to ask ourselves why it is that we have sort of let print journalists and academics define the way we use words on the web. And I think the simple answer to that is they just beat us to it. I think a few people have tried to come up with web content style guides, but they just haven't been embraced by web writers everywhere. I mean, then that's simply because there are web writers everywhere. There are bloggers and journalists and copywriters like myself. And that's great. That's what makes the web so awesome. Because we're all involved in this one big conversation. And I think it's what sets web style apart from style in other media, that it's very conversational. The web is interactive, and our writing should be interactive too. It's exactly what Greg was saying about the kitchen table conversation. If you can sit down and have a conversation with your readers, with what you write, then you're halfway there. You shouldn't be talking at your readers, you should be talking with them. You don't want to make the same mistake that a lot of traditional media companies have made, which is just repurposing print content for the web. The web is its own medium, and you really have to be engaging because of it. A web reader does not read the same as a print reader does. There are a lot of distractions on the web, and a reader can click off your text at any time. It's also another good reason why you should get a writer involved in your information architecture if you don't already have a dedicated department for that, because you need to build in some redundancies just to make sure that if people click off your text, if they're not reading in a linear fashion, they can still get all the information that you want to convey to them. But you also have to do it in a very clever way so that your redundancies don't look like redundancies to people who do read in a linear fashion. These are things that print writers don't really have to think about, but they are things that web writers have to think about. And I have some words of advice for how to write in web style, even though we're defining that really broadly in this conversational idea. First of all, this works for me. It may not work for you, but I'm going to put it out there because I'm sitting here and you're sitting there and you can't leave because the doors are locked from the outside. First of all, write an email. That's what I do. It helps me for a number of reasons. I'm mocked mercilessly in some circles for doing this, but I have a couple practical reasons for doing this and a couple sort of touchy-feely theoretical reasons for doing it too. The two practical reasons are, one, email by default does not put in all kinds of wacky characters that I have to change later when I paste things into code. Also, I can just save things as a draft and access it from anywhere. It's sort of like having your own web app. You just, you know, put a meaningful subject line on it, hit save, and it's always going to be there for you. But the two more important reasons I write in email, one is that I think staring at a blank word processing document is terrifying. I hate seeing that cursor just blinking at me and knowing that there is a page, like a physical page there, that underneath it there are word counts and page breaks, and it's scary. Whereas I think, you know, an email just isn't like that. You know, I don't think we agonize as much over the email form. I think it's really useful just to get started. And the other reason is that email is also a conversational medium. All I would have to do is put someone's name in that to line, and I'm literally kicking off a conversation with them when I write something in email. So even if I think of that subconsciously, I think it's really useful because I'm automatically in that conversational web-style space when I write an email. The second word of advice I would have is to do your research and learn just enough to fake it convincingly, because it's the convincingly part that makes you a good writer, right? I mean, you need to do some research, and you need to know the terminology that you're going to have to lay down for whatever audience you're speaking to. But really, your voice stays with you throughout all of that. Ultimately, when you're talking to a different audience, you're talking with your voice, but you're just adding the sum of all the knowledge you've accumulated on a particular subject on top of it. So when I'm talking to you today, you know, the rhythm of my speech, the cadence, my interjections, that's all part of my voice as a speaker and as a writer. And that should follow me no matter who audience, no matter what kind of audience I'm talking to. So, you know, I may add certain terminology that is relevant to the audience, but ultimately my voice is always still there. So I think that's really important, and it's especially important on the web because, again, we're having this conversation. And finally, I just want to also kind of get back to something that Greg was saying, which is that nobody knows the rules. If you think that writers have every style guide and the dictionary memorized, you are sorely mistaken. You just have to get yourself a few good reference manuals and keep them there and use them whenever you need them. Not even E.B. White, who co-wrote The Elements of Style, knew all the rules. He said, "I felt uneasy at posing as an expert on rhetoric, when the truth is I write by ear, always with difficulty, and seldom with any exact notion of what is taking place under the hood." So the moral of that story is everybody cheats, you know? So just go ahead, cheat. The important thing is that you just get started and get words down on paper. You can always, you know, look it up later. That's not important. The important thing is to just write. Thank you.
So I know we're getting close on time, and I'm about to get the spirit fingers of hurry it up from the back.
Oh,
thank
my
you.
God.
Excellent.
Oh.
Right on time. So I'm going to condense this, which is probably better for all of you anyway. My name is Erin Kassane, and I believe that I am on this panel because I edit a magazine called A List Apart, and I've had the pleasure of editing Mr. Story, and I think he was hoping that I would show up in sort of school marm drag and diagram a sentence and maybe throw around some punctuation rules so that they could all bludgeon me to death at the end of the panel. But even though I am actually a big nerd about that stuff, I try to do that on my own time. So I wanted to dive into, because they've all been so friendly and positive, I thought I'd start out with a negative and tell you about rejection, because it's actually my least favorite part of my job at A List Apart is when we have to say no to things. And the reason we do say no is not usually the reason our writers think we're going to. I don't, and I'm sure this isn't true, but I don't remember having ever had to reject an article because someone didn't know how to use semicolons or follow our style guide and our capitalization of web and internet, or use frequent subheaders, chunk their content, use clear link text, all these things that you learn to rattle off about the mechanics of writing and writing on the web. The reason we sometimes, regrettably, have to say no to things are typically that either it's written for the wrong audience. We're a web design and development and content magazine, so when we get something for C programmers, even if it's close to what we do, we have to send it back. And then sometimes we get articles about gardening, and it's not a metaphor. Sometimes they're very good, but I have to send them back and say, you know, a gardening website might be better. We got a couple of years ago a string of articles on podiatry and foot care from different authors, and then some letters about what's wrong with my foot, and I think maybe you could help, and we couldn't, which was too bad. So knowing who you're writing for, that's important. And it doesn't matter if you're writing for, this doesn't just hold true for technical articles or design articles. I also work on book projects, and this is true for any kind of essays you're doing. It's even true for fiction. So another reason that we sometimes have to send things back is we get things that are too narrow. Someone writes a great article that's four or five sentences long about one tag you can use in one application, in one browser, in one industry, on one project ever. And that's great. It would make a good blog post for that person, maybe. But we can't run them. And sometimes we get articles that talk about how the internet is really cool because it lets you connect with people and it makes you happy and you have friends. And that's true, but it's a little bit too broad for us, so we have to try to work with people to get it focused down. And occasionally, the ones that are really heartbreaking are the ones that we suspect there is a kernel of insight in there that if we could publish the article would possibly revolutionize everything. But it's not clear enough to really tell where the author's going. So I tried to boil those points down into something I could say, sort of cross-genre points to consider. And I told you this would be negative, really it's not. But those things are focus, structure, and clarity. And when I say focus, I'm really talking about knowing who you're speaking to, who your audience is, and what you want to say. It's a good thing to decide that at some point, probably toward the beginning-ish, and then come back to it later and realize if I'm writing for an audience of my grandmother, I shouldn't be using this language. That's a bad idea. The next thing is structure. And Greg talked about writing a good story, and I think we're really saying the same thing here. I think of everything as an argument, because I'm like that, but when you think about structuring an argument, you need to make sure that you've been persuasive. And if you have a supporting example, great, but it shouldn't take up 75% of your article or your essay or whatever it is. So it's about proportion and balance, and you've got to pay attention to that stuff. And finally, clarity, which is my favorite thing. That has to do with going through, making sure you have transitions between your points so they don't seem like they're coming at random. Making sure you fill in gaps so that you really do have an argument and not a bunch of disconnected bullets. Don't like bullets either. And finally, if you're using jargon, is it appropriate? Are you using in-group language for a group who has no idea what you're talking about? So those things are important. But I thought about why those can seem like hostile ideas when you're actually sitting down to write. I know that there are people who are organized writers, and that's so cool. I have no idea how you do it. Those people, they sit down, I believe they plan what they're going to write, and then they do an outline, and then they draft, and then they maybe show it to someone and revise, and presto, you've got this final draft. And I think that's fantastic, but has nothing to do with how I write and with the process of a lot of writers I know. I've tried to outline and then just fill in the blanks, and it completely destroys my will to live. So my process looks more like this. I am a disorganized writer, and I usually start by free writing a couple of pages sort of near a topic, and then I go into the kitchen and have a conversation with my boyfriend and my cats about what I might want to say, and then I write some emails, and I come back and eventually I go through and start doing something that looks like an outline. And then I think, well, who am I really writing this for? Am I saying what I need to say? And then I start moving chunks of text. Don't try to read it. It's a bad idea. move chunks of the ideas around until it starts looking like an actual argument. Play with it. Try making point A, point C. Add some examples. And then I go through and try to make sure that it's clear. Read it out loud to somebody. See if I'm using words or phrases that only make sense to me and my cat, and that kind of thing. So it's not that you need to be scared of these things if you're not an organized writer. You can put these ideas to work for you at any point in your process, as long as it's before you hit send or post or publish. Although it's the web, so you can go back and fix it. But I wanted to say, if you're already a writer of one kind of thing, you're a blogger and you maybe want to do a book chapter or a book, or you're a technical writer and you want to do some kind of literary essay or whatever it might be, these really do work cross-genre. These same things have helped with the academic work I've done, because I'm a nerd like Ethan, and they even work for fiction, so... these are tools that you can use no matter what your actual process is. And don't let anybody force you into doing an outline first, because for a lot of us, it completely kills the fun. And then, you know, you've got nothing.
Fork stab those people.
So, am I okay on time? Do we still have some time for QA? Okay. Then I'm going to kick it back to you guys. That was my super condensed version.
Okay. So the purpose here, again, was to say to get started. Yeah, even if you are writing, continue writing. Write differently. Stretch and improve. Find inspiration. Find inspiration from areas that you wouldn't think about. Being a good writer doesn't mean you have to read, and that's all you do to become a good writer.
Although it's a good start.
Oh yeah, it is a good start. might explain a few things about where I am and why I am. So. And then with Bronwyn is that style, or there are these rules, and that don't let the rules get in the way of developing your voice to go, and don't think that you have to use official writing tools, or don't think that that writers are out there and they do all these perfect things to get their writing out. Everybody's different. It's just a big dice roll, and just go do it. And then finally with Aaron is the kind of the other side of what she sees with all the writing that she has to look at day in and day out. And just her
it's really
experiences.
Not a sad job.
What's that?
It's not a bad job. It's
oh, no.
All this I writing.
Get to, I get to look at the writing at. Day in and day out.
Yeah. Crying in the shower.
So there we have it. Any questions?
There's a microphone here right in this aisle. And since this is apparently going to be a podcast, God help us, can you maybe
pretend
go
pretend you're on Donahue. Go.
Hi, I'm an editor, and I wanted to applaud all of you for what you're saying and add a little bit, if I could. As you write, do everything that they are saying. If you are not particularly at ease with writing or spelling or whatever, find an editor who likes your topic, likes your style, won't mess with your style, and will actually honor your voice and bring you forward and coach you in how to express yourself even better than you already are. If that is not your strong suit, find somebody who can help you. But you are a writer, right? It is the best thing that you can do. Those of us who can't do that, we love to edit that sort of thing. Honor your reader. Don't make them stumble through your misspellings or your concepts that don't segue into each other. Sentence fragments are fine. It is so laid back, but if it's laid back to the point of making the reader stumble, they will leave. And they often won't come back. You want them to come back. So get help if that's what you need.
Thank you.
Those are really good points.
Yeah,
absolutely. Hire us editors. We will make you great writers. You know, even if your editor is your, I don't know, your next-door neighbor or your girlfriend or whatever, it is really important to have somebody else read your work and give you feedback.
Yeah, if for no other reasons, then it's just so important to get a fresh set of eyes on the page. And that sounds really gross now that I've said it. But I think you understand what I mean. It's just, it's not about catching errors necessarily, although that's really hard to do if you've just been locked into writing something for a really long time. You overlook these things. But it's also, you get so close, you can't even really see when you've lost the plot completely. So it's a good editor is really, really important.
Yeah.
Look what we got.
Hi. I'm an editor of a three-person team magazine, also an Alista Part contributor. We found that working within a wiki, I really liked how you talked about writing in an email as opposed to using a word processor. We try to write everything in wiki. We like the version control it keeps. So you're doing your brainstorming. You're throwing paragraphs and sentences all over the place. You know, you make changes, you delete copy, and then you decide, oh, crap, I really wrote something that was really good. I forgot what that was. We go back to that. And we found it's really useful to also look at each other's work as we're building it. Is there anyone else out here that uses other tools besides just a word processor to build their content?
We use, at HappyCog, we use Writeboards a lot also, I should say, as a little project plug for 37 Signals, which his version control is awesome. It's great to be able to kill all of your editor's changes in one fell swoop.
And I know there are some new text editors out there that sort of force you to write forward, not allowing you to revise things that you've written. And I think that is really useful. I personally would get freaked out by it because I tend to do a lot of inline revision, which I think is useful because I like to make sure that my first draft is as clean as possible when it gets to an editor. But in terms of getting started, I think that idea of writing forward and not revising yourself into oblivion is really useful. So I think some of those new applications are really useful too.
I have a question. I'm a writer, so there's so many reference book, AP Style, Elements of Style. Is there one that you feel kind of keeps you in line while not suffocating you?
Well, this actually probably is a good point to mention that very shortly we'll have a companion website for this panel up, and we're going to list each of our sort of favorite reference sources. I think we'd all have a hard time pointing to a single book. But we can, we'll make that available so you can see.
We ran out of time, but it's going to be on writingbetter.com. The domain's registered. Just didn't have time to get the website done before Austin. And we're going to use that space when we can to just put out information that hopefully helps. And, you know, by all means, please send in feedback. Write to us emails and whatnot.
Strunk and White is pretty great.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.